The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Two big questions swirling around the West Wing. Who's healthy and who's sick?
That's a problem for national security and stability around the world.
Israel is dealing with its own coronavirus scare. Some Israelis believe a lockdown is just a sneaky way to suppress dissent.
There's no reason, no good medical reason or anything like that for the lockdown. It's literally just political.
Also today, China wants to grow its influence in Latin America. Panama welcomes the investment, saying Beijing isn't the menace the U.S. makes it out to be.
This is not the China that, you know, they sell you in the movies.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Trump tweeted that he is leaving the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center tonight. He said he's feeling really good. And dangerously, he suggested to Americans, don't be afraid of COVID. Don't let it dominate your life. This comes as the U.S. has recorded 210,000 deaths from the disease. Despite Trump's rosy outlook about his own condition, there's still a lot we don't know. What we do know, nothing about this process has been normal. From the combination of treatments President Trump is receiving for COVID-19 all at once, to the way the outbreak is playing out in his inner circle, the list of infected people is continuing to grow. President Trump's press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, announced today that she too has tested positive for the virus, as well as two of her staffers. For those who specialize in infectious disease control, the White House is setting a bad example for the rest of the globe. Dr. Tom Frieden is a former director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Frieden, how should an outbreak like this in the White House be handled? What are the best practices for prevention, isolation, and quarantining?
Well, first, you want to make sure that you do everything possible to prevent it from happening. And one of the clear lessons here is that testing does not replace safety measures. Tests can be falsely negative, and even if you're negative in the morning, you can be infectious in the afternoon. So yes, testing can play a very important role, but it's only a role as part of a comprehensive strategy. And I think there's no doubt that the fact that there was so much testing going on at the White House gave a false sense of security and allowed this to spread more widely. The second lesson is, once you've got a case, you've got to immediately isolate cases and quarantine contacts. That's how you stop it from spreading very widely. And this has been really an example of what not to do with an outbreak. You haven't quickly isolated cases, you haven't quickly quarantined contacts, and because of that, there's been a fair amount of spread.
As you follow the headlines and the news from the White House, what concerns you the most about how this is being handled?
I hope it will be a lesson of what we as a country can do better, because right now, COVID has the upper hand. Because of that, more than 210,000 Americans have been killed by this virus. And last Thursday, when the president developed his illness, another 40,000 people were diagnosed, and probably 200,000 people total got newly infected on that day. Of those people, about 1,000 will die. These are really mind-boggling numbers, and we need to do a much better job of preventing it from spreading by the three W's: wear a mask, watch your distance, wash your hands, and by doing a really good job, not just of testing, but rapid isolation, complete contact tracing, and supportive quarantine. Countries all over the world are doing this, but we're not succeeding in the U.S.
It was reported that the CDC had offered to help with the White House, but the White House passed. I know the CDC assists other countries' CDCs. They're kind of the mothership. So what's the impact around the globe when the CDC is ignored domestically?
What we've seen in countries all over and in states and cities around the U.S. is that governments that are guided by public health and that fully support public health do better. They have fewer cases, less death, less economic devastation, and when cases and clusters do occur, they're stopped before they become widespread.
How concerned are you by what's happening at the White House influencing the behavior of others and just trust in public health to do things like quarantine after an exposure?
Well, start with masks. We're already seeing in communities all over the U.S., including parts of New York City where I live, people not wearing masks and citing the White House as an example. Now, the White House has said that it's important to wear masks, but you have to show it by your behavior as well. And then when it comes to rapid isolation, someone who has COVID needs to be isolated for generally 10 days and should only potentially risk others for a medically necessary procedure. And someone who's been exposed to COVID needs to quarantine for 14 days so that they can reduce the risk that they would spread it to others.
Are you expecting the president, after this experience, to be a better communicator of this disease?
I can only hope that he has a speedy and full recovery and that we as a country will recognize that we're all connected and that disease anywhere is potentially a risk everywhere. And the more we're divided, the more the virus will continue to conquer us. The more we work together and follow proven principles of finding, preventing, and stopping the spread of this infection, the more lives we'll save and the sooner we'll get our jobs and economy back.
Dr. Tom Frieden, the former director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Good speaking with you.
Since President Trump and the First Lady announced they had tested positive for the coronavirus, the news cycle has been a whirlwind. The commander-in-chief is sidelined from at least some of his duties, so it makes sense to ask whether China, Russia, or other actors who don't always have America's best interests in mind might take advantage of the U.S. at this precarious moment. Garrett Graff has been thinking a lot about this. He's a writer and national security analyst.
You see various aides and various members of the National Security Council testing positive for COVID, isolating themselves, being treated themselves. You know, the president is physically unable to be in a room with his top military and government officials. And frankly, this is a West Wing that, as of today, is simply concerned with its own health. They physically don't know who among them is sick and how far this virus has spread in their own ranks. That's a recipe for instability and uncertainty that is the type of opportunity foreign adversaries would normally try to take advantage of, even before you begin to factor in that we are just weeks away from what was already promising to be a fraught and potentially challenging election.
Do you have a clear sense of when President Trump's most recent national security briefing was?
Presumably, he is continuing to get briefings all the time. If Mike Pence actually does have to step in at some point under the what's called the acting president procedures, and power is officially transferred to him using the 25th Amendment. Let's say if the president's condition worsens or he undergoes a medical treatment requiring anesthesia. One of the oddities is that actually vice presidents are typically even better informed about U.S. intelligence than presidents because they have more time to spend receiving intelligence briefings.
So whether it's at Walter Reed or possibly soon at the White House, who is briefing him? Is it Robert O'Brien? And are they socially distanced?
The president's intelligence briefing generally takes place now on an iPad. And so it would be relatively easy to continue that briefing in a socially distanced way. So, I mean, there's a much larger issue that throughout this administration, the president has actually not paid that much attention to his briefings, that they have been sort of dumbed down and had to be rewritten with more graphics and less information because of how boring the president finds most of the routine intelligence briefings that he receives.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that and whether, because of what you just pointed out, much actually changes right now.
Yeah, it's hard to say how much is really changing in this moment, except this is just a massive distraction. It's easy to forget how fraught and challenging this year has already been, as you have seen China use the pandemic as cover to move against the freedom and independence of Hong Kong. Azerbaijan and Armenia are engaged in an outright war right now, heavily influenced by regional powers, Russia and Turkey. India and China, 2 billion person nuclear armed countries, are continuing to have border clashes that have erupted in fighting and casualties for the first time since the 1970s. There's a lot of stuff going on in the world right now, and having the West Wing and having the National Security Council focused hour by hour on how healthy they are themselves, that's a problem for national security and stability around the world.
I got to ask you about the nuclear football, the briefcase with the information for a president to launch a nuclear attack. It was suggested on Friday, as I watched the president take Marine One to Walter Reed, that one of his aides was carrying the nuclear football. Is that correct? And does it remain with him in quarantine in that room at Walter Reed?
Perhaps not physically in the room, but the nuclear football, which is carried by a rotating set of 5 military aides, is never far from him physically. It rides with him in an elevator if he's in an elevator. It is in the 3rd golf cart behind the president's golf cart if he is on the course. It is always close by.
If the president's health improves, I mean, he's still been taking some medications that have known side effects, including making your brain kind of hazy, dexamethasone. And there's also the long-term impact of COVID-19. How would it be determined if the president was not cognitively up to the task of being commander-in-chief?
We don't have a good mechanism politically, militarily, legally, constitutionally to deal with a president who is not mentally fit to be president. And in fact, the 25th Amendment, which does lay out a procedure for removing the president with the assent of the vice president and a majority of the cabinet, that's a pretty blunt instrument and a politically fraught one to deal with mental instability and not physical disability.
Little surprise that lately a lot of us find ourselves with bouts of insomnia. Garrett, what's crossing your mind on these recent nights that you can't sleep?
For me, it is all about this month's election security, not just in terms of the president and his health, but also the questions that he has been trying to inject into the process over recent weeks about the legitimacy of the election itself, and putting out the message that if he loses, it is because the election has been stolen from him. You know, that basic premise of a peaceful transition of power has long been a bedrock of American democracy. And this president openly questioning it as recently as this weekend is very troubling for the groundwork that it is laying for what might happen in the hours after the polls close on November 3rd.
Garrett Graff is a writer and analyst. He's the author of The Only Plane in the Sky, an oral history of 9/11. Garrett, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Some sad news out of Ireland. One of the country's most beloved poets, Derek Mann, has died. Mann was born in Belfast in Northern Ireland. He passed away at his home in Kinsale last Thursday at the age of 78 after a short illness. His poems dealt with themes of loneliness and isolation, but also hope. That made his work especially apt for these times. In the early days of the pandemic in March, Mann's poem, Everything is Going to Be All Right, took on new meaning and relevance. It was played by Irish broadcaster RTE at the end of its evening news program. Here's actor Andrew Scott, the star of Fleabag, reading Derek Mann's poem, Everything is Going to Be All Right.
How should I not be glad to contemplate the clouds clearing beyond the dormer window? And a high tide reflecting on the ceiling. There will be dying. There will be dying. But there's no need to go into that. The poems flow from the hand, unbidden. And the hidden source is the watchful heart. The sun rises, in spite of everything. And the far cities are beautiful and bright. I lie here in a riot of sunlight, watching the day break and the clouds flying. Everything's going to be all right.
Everything is going to be all right. Precious words of reassurance from the late Irish poet Derek Mann, read by actor Andrew Scott. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It started around 7 on Saturday night in cities and towns across Israel. all over the country, people came out to protest. They're calling on Benjamin Netanyahu to resign. Israel's prime minister is facing corruption charges in court. That's not all. People are also angry about a law passed last week aimed at stopping anti-government demonstrations during the pandemic. The World's Ariel Osseran reports from Tel Aviv.
49-year-old Itai Shaked joins a group of more than 200 protesters, banging pots and pans and waving black flags in Tel Aviv suburb. Their frustration is aimed at one man, and that's Benjamin Netanyahu.
He cares only for himself and not for us. That's why I'm here today.
Shaked says the prime minister needs to resign, and drivers nearby seem to agree. Weekly protests against Netanyahu have been going on for more than 4 months. The main protest site was at the prime minister's residence in Jerusalem, but the new emergency law limits people's movements. Protesters are prohibited from traveling more than a kilometer from their homes. Shaked says the law crosses a line.
It made me feel bad because I don't want to lose my right to protest.
This is not just about the pandemic, he tells me. 33-year-old Lior Wertheim says she would rather be protesting outside of the prime minister's residence, but that's against the law now. So here she is, protesting down the street from where she and her partner live.
We're also on a WhatsApp group, and also we hear whenever people are here, and we just come down.
How often does that happen?
Once, twice a week. I hope that it gets more and more often these days.
Israel went into a second lockdown 2 weeks ago. Since then, coronavirus cases have skyrocketed to 9,000 daily infections. But Wertheim says that's not the real reason for strict measures against protests.
It's really just, like, upsetting, because there's no reason, no good medical reason or anything like that for the lockdown. It's literally just political.
And that's something I'm hearing from many protesters. Yochanan Plesner, president of the Israel Democracy Institute, has his doubts too. He says the prime minister's decision to crack down on protests goes against the advice of his own health officials.
The uniqueness about the restrictions in Israel are the level of severity and the fact that the prime minister turned it into such a major issue in fighting the pandemic.
The economy is taking a hit too, Plesnell says. The restrictions forced many small businesses to close, which is just fueling the protests against Netanyahu.
It seems that the only logical explanation is that he wanted to, in this way, justify the severe restrictions on the right to protest.
One of the biggest turnouts on Saturday night was Habima Square in downtown Tel Aviv. It seems the police has put up barriers to divide between protesters and separate them into some sort of bubbles. But that just makes it a lot harder to maintain social distancing. As the crowd grows, the arrests begin. Every few minutes, another protester is snatched from the crowd and put into a police van.
There's a protester being arrested, and people are surrounding the cops.
Protesters yell shame as the cops drag a demonstrator away. By the end of the night, police make a total of 38 arrests.
Protesters with cameras are surrounding them. People asking, "Why did you arrest him?" They're saying release him.
At one point, police start handing out tickets to protesters for violating the 1 kilometer rule and for not keeping 6 feet apart from one another. Lilach Sapir owns a bar in the neighborhood, but it's been closed for 2 weeks now. She's one of the national organizers of these neighborhood protests.
Started with a small post I put on Facebook. Saying if we can't have 10,000 people in Balfour, then we'll have 10,000 places of demonstration all over Israel in each kilometer.
Balfour is a reference to the street where Netanyahu's office residence is located. Sapir and other activists are mapping the weekly neighborhood protests online under the motto, 1 kilometer it is.
This is why we made Kilometer It Is, to make people be able to protest and not be someone who breaks the rules.
Sapir says she's had to dig into family savings just to make ends meet. That's the case with many Israelis, she says, and it's why people are directing their anger directly at Netanyahu.
They understand he doesn't care about them. He's not dealing about the economy. He should have been very wise with economy. It's one of the things he knows how to do.
Benjamin Netanyahu is Israel's longest-serving prime minister. Back in the 1990s, he earned the nickname Mr. Economy. But Yochanan Plesner from the Israel Democracy Institute says Netanyahu's approval ratings with the Israeli public have now sunk to 27%.
They don't trust the effectiveness of the government that did not seem to build the proper systems and policies and frameworks to deal with the crisis.
Plesner says what's happening now is a dramatic drop in compliance with health and safety regulations. The protests don't seem to be losing support. And with winter just around the corner, that means Israel could be in a state of lockdown for some time to come. For The World, I'm Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv.
Across the globe, we're seeing other kinds of protests. People in the Armenian diaspora are making their voices heard.
Hey, we are still here. After 100 years, where are we? We are here on Sunset Boulevard in America.
After 100 years, where are we? We are here on Sunset Boulevard in America. That's Los Angeles this weekend, where hundreds of people rallied to support Armenians in the region of Nagorno-Karabakh. For a second straight week, Armenia and Azerbaijan are battling over the contested region of Nagorno-Karabakh in the Caucasus, where Europe and Asia meet. Dozens of casualties have been reported as rocket fire goes back and forth. Both sides are saying the other is targeting civilians. One of those protesters in Los Angeles is a young activist named Alex Galitsky, who was showing his support for Armenia.
These people, more than anything, want peace. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind. The people of Artsakh just want the right to live freely and peacefully in the lands they've inhabited for many, many millennia, without the fear of persecution.
We'll hear more from Alex in Los Angeles tomorrow here on The World. Before we take a short break here on the radio, I wanted to let you know about another way we can connect. Start your morning with us and a cup full of news stories from around the globe. That'd be our newsletter, Top of the World. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters and start the day informed. You're listening to The World. Venice, Italy, has dealt with flooding for centuries. Now they have barriers to hold back rising seas. This weekend, they were put to the test.
It's amazing. It worked.
Also ahead, China reacts to President Trump's COVID diagnosis with a bit of dark humor. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. It was designed by American engineers more than a century ago. Even in the 21st century, the Panama Canal is still an engineering marvel.
It's all done by gravity. Water will always seek its lowest level possible, opening and closing.
The canal is also still one of the most strategic waterways on Earth, especially for the United States. Get this, 2 of every 3 ships heading to American ports pass through the Panama Canal. Today, we take a deep dive into Panama's evolving relationship with another country, China.
As a Panamanian band plays, we cruise down a canal where China's expanded a port on the Atlantic side, built a cruise ship terminal on the Pacific side, and is building a bridge over the canal itself.
That's veteran China reporter Mary Kay Magstad. She's the creator of the podcast On China's New Silk Road in collaboration with the Global Reporting Center. As Mary Kay explains in this story, Panama, back in 2017, became the first Latin American country to join what's called the Belt and Road, China's global infrastructure project.
Americans didn't just build the Panama Canal. They controlled it for the better part of a century, after the U.S. military helped Panama break off from Colombia and become its own country in 1903. And if you walk near the Pacific entrance to the Panama Canal in Panama City, you may stumble upon a peaceful wooded area with the graffiti-covered ruins of former American villas, shops, government buildings, even an old movie theater.
When the photographer and I came to this report, there were like a lot of cars, you know, with people sleeping in them.
This is Luis Barón. He's an investigative reporter with La Prensa newspaper in Panama. In fact, he helped report out the Panama Papers, the leak of millions of encrypted financial and legal records from a Panama-based law firm that led to resignations, prosecutions, and changes to law around the world related to crime and corruption. And he's showing me around this area, the former Panama Canal Zone. It was an unincorporated territory of the United States from 1903 to 1979. It stretched 10 miles wide and the entire length of the Panama Canal. Luis did a story here a while back. It was called A Ruined Eden.
I mean, the Panama Canal Zone was the perfect place to live because, you know, you have all the U.S. regulations, the U.S. food, the U.S. law. You had the U.S. protection because you had, it was like a perfect society, a utopian society, but you were in a tropical environment. You know, it was like a little piece of heaven.
If you were American. And a few notable Americans lived here.
John McCain, he was born on the Panama Canal Zone. And I can't remember his name. I know his last name is Murphy from the Murphy Law. Mm-hmm. You know that everything that could get worse, it will get worse.
You mean it was that Murphy?
Yeah, he was also Zonian.
Zonian, as in living in the Panama Canal Zone under U.S. law and U.S. protection. When the U.S. controlled the canal, Panamanians, by and large, were not allowed to go into the Panama Canal Zone. That created both a mystique and a resentment, and eventually a push for an end to what pro-independence protesters saw as this neo-colonial American presence. And now, a short walk from these abandoned American buildings at the mouth of the Panama Canal is a brand new, sprawling convention center built by a Chinese contractor. China had also been angling to build a new embassy in this area, right at the mouth of the Panama Canal. Those plans changed after the U.S. government and many Panamanians pushed back hard.
Yo opino que venir a invertir a Panamá no está mal.
This is Francisco Quesada. He's a 24-year-old photographer we bumped into as we were checking out the ruins in the old Panama Canal Zone. We got chatting about what he thinks of the growing Chinese presence and investments in Panama.
Okay, he says that foreign investment is always good and always welcome. What we have to do is watch really close what are the real intentions behind that investment. We could not accept investment that could harm our country. For example, the thing that happened with the Chinese embassy that wanted to take out some old Panama Canal Zone land, and we as Panamanians opposed to that. I think every country can bring its investment here in Panama as long as it brings something good for us.
China pitches its new Silk Road investments as something that will do just that. China's leaders say this will be a win-win for all countries that participate, creating a global community of shared destiny. Luis, having just been on a Chinese government-organized trip for Latin American journalists to China, finds China's rhetoric like this to be a bit much.
What they were insisting on is, you know, one of the phrases one of them used is like, we have a good heart, you could trust us. That is what everyone says. But they want to sell this image that they are helping us because they wanted to see flourish, you know? Like, they have no interest. Just, you know, I want to see Panama growing because we have a good heart and we want like a perfect world.
You seem not entirely sold.
Not really, not even a little bit. We're all grown-ups. You can tell the truth. You can speak the truth. You don't have to hide behind that image.
After all, he says, Panama's about business. We get it. China's leaders haven't been laying out more than $500 billion so far in loans and investments around the world just out of the goodness of their hearts. They're building a new network of global trade that puts China at the center, while also being present in ports and other places that are strategically important to China's interests. And with Panama taking a hit from COVID-19, help for Panama's economy would actually be welcome. Except, Luis isn't sure that what China is offering is going to get where it needs to go to improve ordinary people's lives in Panama.
China's aspiration in this region, I think it could benefit these countries. But since we have like corrupt governments in almost all of the Latin American countries. I don't think the China aspiration and investment into this country would benefit us. If bad managed, we could end up like Sri Lanka. That could be a real scenario for us.
That China would take over control of the Panama Canal or something like that?
I don't think the Panama Canal, but they could take control of a port, a chunk of land of Panama. And we are like really experienced giving away land.
All along the New Silk Road, people are paying attention to what happened in Sri Lanka. And here's what happened. China extended sizable loans so a Chinese state-owned company could come in and build a port and an airport that Sri Lanka didn't really need. In fact, they barely got any business. And when Sri Lanka couldn't afford to pay its debt in 2017, the Chinese side pushed for a deal that gave China majority control of the port and of a huge area around it for 99 years.
I did see that in Sri Lanka. It's very sad.
This is Johnny Wong. He's a Panamanian of Chinese descent, a mechanical engineer with degrees from the University of Texas and Stanford, who worked on the Panama Canal for 3 decades.
I went to a training. It was on ports seminar. And there were a large group from Sri Lanka. And in a way, I don't want to be offensive, but I was a bit sorry for them. But I don't think you cannot blame everything to the Chinese, you know, who signed that. You know, some ambitious leader or wanted a big project. So I think we have to play smart and play by have everything, all the concessions given by open competition with transparency.
Johnny says that's what he did when he was designing and overseeing parts of a Panama Canal expansion project from 2007 to 2016. It added an extra lane and doubled the canal's capacity.
Even from the high in the government, they have recognized the canal is running efficiently, and they even say it's running better now than in the older system.
When the U.S. was controlling it.
It's controlling it. We can react quicker to customer needs. It's more like a running quasi privately, like a private, but try to respond to our clients.
And he says the canal is making more money now and putting more money into government coffers. In fact, Panama's got enough money to fund infrastructure projects that Chinese companies have done or are doing that so far it hasn't had to rely on loans from China, like Sri Lanka did. Johnny says as a Panamanian, he's proud of what Panama's been able to do on its own. But he recognizes Panama still has to balance its relationships with contending superpowers.
And in the end, we are just a little pawn on the chessboard. We're not that big. We cannot change the influence of power. We're just a little piece that gets moved. So.
As someone of Chinese heritage, are you looking at what's happening with China's growing presence in the world and thinking, this is kind of great?
In a way, yes. Now, you know, you can feel the pride of it being more modern, people being exposed, like in your case. You say, hey, this is not the China that, you know, they sell you in the movies.
But Luis, the journalist, tells me a funny thing happened to China's Panama plans after elections brought in a new Panamanian president, Laurentino Cortizo, in May 2019.
With this new government, that project like stopped. I don't know if it was like we're not going to do it or it just like stopped till see if they can get offer a better deal. I don't know. But the relations with China have getting cold with this government.
Or it could be this. The U.S. government has been pushing back hard against China's expanding presence in Panama, Mexico, and Latin America in general. Just weeks before Chinese President Xi Jinping visited Panama in late 2018, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visited Panama and warned against what he called China's predatory economic activity. Since then, Chinese projects started being scaled back, canceled, or rejected. $4 billion high-speed rail? No thanks. building a $2.5 billion monorail linking Panama City with its western suburbs? Nah, we'll have South Korea's Hyundai do it instead. That new Panama Canal bridge being built by a top Chinese state-owned company? Scaled back. Negotiations with China for a free trade agreement? Stalled. And Panama's government has said it will audit the Hong Kong company Hutchison Ports that has for 20 years operated Panama's ports at either end of the canal, while considering whether to renew its concession when it expires in 2022. Whether any of that changes or reverses as a result of the hit Panama Canal traffic and profits have taken from COVID-19 is not yet clear. What is clear is the Trump administration's desire to push China out of America's backyard. That includes in Mexico, which is not yet one of China's new Silk Road partners, but has been exploring its options.
Mary Kay Magstad reporting there from an episode of the podcast on China's New Silk Road, another place in Latin America where the Trump administration is pushing back against China's ambitions is Mexico. The Mexican government has not signed on to the Belt and Road Project. Not yet, at least. I'm joined by Isabella Cota in Mexico City. She's the economics correspondent for the Spanish newspaper El País and co-reported with Mary Kay for this episode of the podcast. I'd like to know first more about the Mexican economy right now, Isabella. How has the pandemic impacted it, and what's been the hit on people there?
It's really hard in Mexico to know exactly how many jobs have been lost through this pandemic, because more than half of the economy is informal. But officials, specifically the statistics agency, they estimate that around 6 million people have lost their source of income over the course of the pandemic so far. Living in Mexico City, for example, it's very visible how this pandemic has hit people so hard. You know, you get knocks on the door and people ring on your doorbell every day looking for money or asking for work because they've lost their job as maybe a waiter or, you know, a driver in the last 6 months. So it's been truly devastating for Mexico.
So a big informal economy, an important one in Mexico. Let's look at the formal economy, specifically the auto industry. The auto industry is big in Mexico, and Chinese car companies have been players there for quite some time. How does the government in Mexico City view the presence of China helping out economically? Is there a path through this economic hit from COVID with the help of China?
You know, I'm not so sure about a path itself. I mean, I guess the United States, you know, is so important. We are so highly integrated that for the Mexican government, it's a little bit of a tricky situation to talk about a specific investment strategy or path alongside China or with the help of China. What I would say is more than anything, the auto industry in Mexico has attracted companies from all over the world, from Japan and Korea. We have one of the biggest Kia plants are in Mexico, for example. So it's not just China. Mexico is really becoming an automotive force for exports as well as manufacturing.
Mexico is part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trading bloc, and that bloc does not include the U.S. The Trump administration backed away from it. But Mexico has not signed on to China's Belt and Road Project. Why not?
Well, this goes back to the idea that Mexico is kind of in the U.S.'s backyard. We know fully well that the U.S. is Mexico's top trading partner, with 80% of exports being sent to the United States. And our second trading partner is China. And it's been the case for the last 13, 14 years. So the risk is that we become dependent on both of these countries.
Beyond the auto industry, Isabella, what sort of Chinese state-run projects are you seeing in Mexico right now?
Huawei's, the Chinese telecommunications company, is building a 5G infrastructure along the border on the Mexico side, along the border with the United States. That's a project that has been creating a lot of buzz in recent years. Another one, which was announced this year, a Chinese state-owned company will be working in the first tranche of the Tren Maya. This will be a government project. That is, it will be a train that will run from the Yucatan Peninsula all the way through the jungle, and it's meant for tourists.
Wow.
It's meant to attract around 8,000 tourists. And the Chinese company got the contract, the government contract, along in a kind of consortium with local companies as well. the biggest investment last year, which was for about $400 million, was by the energy company Sinuk. And it's for its base of operations in the port of Tampico. So we know that these investments are going to be very, very large, and the Chinese participation in these large projects is going to be very important during this administration.
So sizable Chinese investment in Mexico, and yet Mexico is not on the Belt and Road project, but it has not ruled it out, has it? So what circumstances might force Mexico to seal the deal, or do you just not see that happening?
I don't really know if this government is going to be the one that manages to do that, that manages to keep economic and diplomatic relations with the United States going strong as neighbors, as top trading partners, and at the same time signs off to the Belt and Road Initiative. I'm not sure they're going to manage, but I think that they're going to try. And quite frankly, I mean, considering the moment that we're living now with the pandemic, I hope they do, because Mexico needs all the investment and all the economic opportunities that we can get.
Isabella Cota, correspondent with the newspaper El País. She also co-reported the latest episode of the podcast on China's New Silk Road. Isabella, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We return to our top story now, President Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis. In China, President Xi Jinping and his wife sent their best wishes to the president and First Lady Melania Trump. Chinese state-run media there making the announcement, saying President Xi wishes the Trumps a fast recovery. Joining me is Rebecca Canther, our Shanghai correspondent. Rebecca, you've been speaking with people today in Shanghai. What are the reactions you're hearing to the news of President Trump's diagnosis?
Well, what you have to understand is right now the entire country is on an 8-day holiday. So there's a lot of people who have nothing better to do right now than look at the news and talk about this. So it was pretty big news here. Some people didn't really believe the news at first, and it wasn't reported right away on state media, so that's understandable. I checked in with Wei Zongyou. He's a professor at the Center for American Studies at Fudan University. And he said some people thought that Trump getting COVID was kind of a bit of karma.
They think that it's a kind of punishment. But some other people think that he got the disease and they wish him well. They wish him a speedy recovery. But some other scholars, they may think that this incident may have some kind of impact on the general election.
And then, of course, there were plenty of snarky jokes being made.
Yeah, I'm assuming dark humor. What are some of the jokes that were being made?
I mean, some people were joking that this was like a national day gift to China because it's the national day holiday here. And, you know, there's been this joke going around for a while now that Trump's actions just sort of further the rise of China. So they call him Chuan Jianguo, which means build the country Trump. So him getting the virus during the national day holiday sort of led to a lot of joking on the part of Chinese people. So I spoke to this editor, Wang Xia, and she explained that most people were seeing this more as kind of like entertainment news rather than political news. What she was saying was that this shows anyone can get the virus, no matter their race or their nationality or economic status. Despite the jokes, several people I spoke to and a lot of people on social media felt real concern about the president's health.
Rebecca, could President Trump's diagnosis have any real impact on U.S.-Chinese relations? What are you hearing?
Well, I think people here definitely are concerned about that. I spoke with a journalist, Zhu Youke, and he said that he's worried that the diagnosis could lead to a harsher tone on China because that's where the virus was first detected. He said he was quite worried for the president's health. I mean, he's an older person, he said, and he doesn't like all those jokes. But he definitely was concerned, okay, you know, whether Trump would take out some anger on China after being diagnosed. Then I talked again with Professor Wei, and he said that, you know, President Xi sending a message to President Trump and the First Lady might be seen as a positive step in the relationship between the two countries. But then again, you know, just this morning, Foreign Ministry spokesperson Hua Chunying, she couldn't resist another little jab. She posted on Twitter that she hopes that, you know, all the new cases of COVID-19, all the people getting COVID-19 in the U.S. could receive as good of a treatment as Trump is getting.
The World's Rebecca Canther, our Shanghai correspondent. Thanks very much for this.
Thank you.
I have some good news to tell you about today, a story from Venice, Italy. After decades of waiting, the gates designed to hold back the rising Adriatic Sea were tested this weekend, and they worked. The World's Anna Kusmer reports.
For the first time in 1,200 years, Venice held back floodwaters. Starting every autumn, the city has these acqua altas, or especially high tides, that flood the streets. But this year, four flood barriers, they kind of look like big yellow walls emerging from the water, were raised in the lagoon just outside the city, and they stopped the water. The streets and plazas of Venice were dry.
So good morning from Venice.
Maria Gabriella is an antique shop owner. She took a video outside her shop. It shows people outside wearing masks, walking around, going to restaurants and shopping.
And I know that everything looks perfectly normal to your eyes. As you can see, the water is inside the canal. But for us living here, it's something unbelievably amazing.
The bright yellow barriers are part of a multi-billion dollar project called MOS. The project has long been the planned solution to Venice's flooding problem, but it's been delayed for decades. Dozens of people, including a former mayor of Venice, have been arrested for corruption in connection with the project. MOS has been tested once before, but this is the first time the barriers have been used to prevent the Adriatic Sea from inundating the city.
And we are really amazed. Like, I would have never believed something like this could happen. Of course, it's just the first time, so we don't have just to get too much excited about it. Let's wait and see how it's going to be in the future. But it's amazing. It worked.
In recent years, these seasonal high tides have gotten more frequent and severe. Last November, the city had its worst flood in 50 years. Two people died. The MOS project was designed to help the watery city withstand the rising sea levels. Venice Mayor Luigi Brugnaro posted videos online from a boat in the lagoon overlooking the yellow MOS barriers. Later, Brugnaro told reporters, "We stopped the sea." In another video, Brugnaro says, "It's a triumphal day for us in Venice."
È una giornata trionfale oggi per noi, per Venezia.
He says, "We have shown that MOS's engineering works."
Siamo molto contenti perché dopo tanti anni che qualcuno
diceva. He says, "We're very happy because after so many years, people said it would never work." The barriers are designed to protect Venice from higher floodwaters than it's ever seen. But with climate change pushing sea levels up, some worry how long they'll be effective. For The World, I'm Anna Kusmer.
And that's where we leave things today on the radio. We're always online at theworld.org. Be safe, stay strong, stay healthy. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.